Hello and welcome. I'm Rick Bucata, Medical Director here at the Center for Medical Education. Thanks for joining us for our podcast. Today's presentation is entitled Opiate Use Disorder in the Emergency Department. It's from our series that we call MPREP. In it, we address each of the required readings in the American Board of Emergency Medicine, what they call their LLSA series. We're happy to have Diane Birnbaumer and Billy Mallon co-presenting. Diane was the Associate Emergency Medicine Residency Director at Harbor General Hospital here in Los Angeles for 20 years and has been the recipient of the ASEP Outstanding Contribution in Emergency Medicine Award and also has been recognized as ASEP Speaker of the Year. And Billy has most recently been on faculty at the Emergency Department at State University of New York at Stony Brook and has been the Emergency Medicine Residency Director here at Los Angeles County USC Medical Center in the past, and that's where I met him. And like Diane, Billy recently received the ASEP Outstanding Contribution in Emergency Medicine Award. I know you'll enjoy their tag team presentation.
Skip to or move on now to Article 11. This is opioid use.
You sure you don't want to skip it?
Yeah. No, this one's important. This one's important.
It is. It is.
So,
go ahead.
Opioid use disorder
you
in the ED.
You tempted me with skip.
Yes, I know. You rise to that bait, just grabbed it right away. The title of this is Identification, Management, and Transition of Care for Patients with Opioid Use Disorder in the Emergency Department. This is by Herbie Duber, who's actually a graduate of our program and a wonderful, wonderful person. And this is an area he's quite the
Did you
expert.
Call him the Dubes at work?
No, we called him lots of things, but yes, that's Herbie. He was Herbie. He's actually a great, great guy. Really wonderful. And this is a really useful article. It's the Annals of Emergency Medicine in 2018. And we all know it's just splattered all over the news. This is part of life. It's just a really terrible thing. Opioid misuse, for lots of reasons on how we've gotten here, it's a really major healthcare issue, like a gigantic healthcare issue. And I'll tell you, it affects everybody. This isn't just the heroin abuser in the shooting gallery somewhere in a house. This is everybody. This is the 16-year-old taking his parents' Vicodin. This is the business executive who had shoulder surgery and now is addicted to oxycodone. This just covers all socioeconomic statuses across the board. And it's considered a national crisis in the United States, and I think deservedly so. It is actually, the number is eye-popping. So it's 1.4% of the U.S. population over the age of 12 misuses pain medicines. So if you take our population, that puts us up to 4 to 5 million people misuse pain medication. That's remarkable. And that doesn't count the group that actually uses heroin. That's a totally separate group.
Doesn't count the group that's using fentanyl.
Right. It's really a big problem. And I think those of us that work in the emergency medicine know that. People who work in social work know this. And families are just getting destroyed by this. We have colleagues. We have a colleague in our college in emergency medicine who lost a grown child to this. And it's just really, really devastating. It's incredibly difficult because the deaths are increasing. So this colleague of ours who's child died of an overdose. This is real. It's 200% increase in the last 20 years. That's just enormous. And what's driving the deaths actually isn't the pills so much as the heroin and the synthetic opioids. People basically ramp it up to using heroin and synthetic opioids. And that's really what's driving these overdose deaths. And we are on the forefront of this, basically the pre-hospital personnel and those of us in the emergency department, because we treat these overdoses. We treat the complications from people who use opioids. We treat the long-term addicted patients that come in for lots of different reasons, either problems from the opioid addiction or wanting more medicine. We see this all the time. Now, one of the things that does get thrown around that I want to kind of squelch at this point is this idea that our prescriptions are the reason we have the problem. And that's absolutely not the case. We account for only about 5% of total opioids prescribed. And we do know that we're trying not to prescribe opioids if we don't have to, trying to use other kinds of pain control, ways to address people's pain. We are not the driver of the problem here. We can be a contributor, though, to the problem here. And our controlling our opioid prescription is one way to get at it. And we'll talk about that later as far as interventions are concerned. So what would be helpful is to have a best practice of how to deal with opioid use disorder in the ER. We'd love to have just a best practice. Here's how you screen people. Here's how you treat them. Here's why you refer them. They need to be done and developed and tested and followed, and we don't really have them yet. It requires a whole lot of things to make that work. Anything from education at our end of knowing how to recognize it and how to treat it, and then follow up to have treatment centers and resources available. But it is true that because we see so much of this in our practice, that we may be a really good portal of entry to get a handle on this or address any particular individual with opioid use disorder, which would start with screening, right? We'd have to pick up the people who have opioid use disorder. And there are tools out there to do this. There's screening tools, actually quite a few of them out there, that give you an idea. They're reliable. Most of them have been tested. Some of them are easy to use, some not so easy to use in the ER. And what Dr. Duber, Herbie says in this paper, is that if we're really going to use these tools in the ER, if we're going to be the screening place for this, it has to integrate into our usual workflow. This can't be something where you have to take a 10-minute step aside and do a bunch of other, you know, time. You just don't have the time. So that poses...
I think it also has to come with ED resources.
Yes.
So right. At Stony Brook, we went to basically almost 24-hour social work availability. We have this whole group that comes in and does screening and does a whole questionnaire form and things. So... Yeah, I'm happy to be involved with it if you're going to give me resources to get it done.
Well, and that will make it work, right? That's going to increase the likelihood of it, because honestly, if it's put on, I'll tell you, putting it on ER nurses or ER docs is not the place to kind of add this. We have plenty on our plate already of how to, you know, dealing with practice parameters and, you know, guidelines
and
all this other stuff.
That's why I said you have to add resources.
Right. So,
and it has to either be a specific drug person or a social worker or both.
Right. And that is a challenge, right? Because that means money. That means money. So that does pose a challenge to this. But I'll tell you, the bang for your buck is pretty good. And we'll get into that in a little while. The screening tools that are available, by the way, in that article, there's a lot of detail on it if you're interested in knowing what they are. Some are self-done. Some are administered by somebody else. Not all of them are validated, but most of them are. And each of them has a little different goal. Some of them, I want to find who has an opioid use disorder. Another one may say, I want to know who's at risk of overdosing, not just who's using, but who can overdose. They have different goals. Just know that there's lots of things out there. And if you end up with resources available to you, it's something you could implement and pick the one that works for what you're looking for. Now, we do know that what a lot of us have, and this is actually mandated for a lot of us who are listening to this sort of lecture, is that we have drug monitoring programs that can be used as a screening tool. We know that. And we also know that there are these databases out there. What we find is that these programs and these databases may decrease opioid-related overdose deaths, but what they don't do, the drug monitoring programs in particular, don't pick up is the non-prescription opioid use. So the people that are out there using heroin, these monitoring programs that are screening for somebody who's, you know, comes in to a job, et cetera, they may not pick up the non-prescription opioid use, and some of these programs don't pick up, if they're doing testing, don't pick up the right kind of, they don't even pick it up at all. So the article basically says, don't use just a monitoring program is the only tool. Pick a combination of things, you know, consulting the reporting database, doing some sort of screening program, you know, finding some combination of self-reported and screening that will help you pick up opioid use disorder. There's no formal guidelines basically on who to do this, you know, whom to screen. Like, do you do everybody? If it could be that 16-year-old with the ankle sprain and the business guy who's there with his chest pain who could also be opioid use disorder, do you do everybody? That doesn't make sense. Universal screening isn't recommended and it's not practical. It just isn't. But you can use, you know, people who have either a history of opioid misuse, a history of overdoses, a positive drug screen if that's done, that those may be things that will tell you that their risk for being an opioid use disorder person. There's a couple other concepts about this. So when it comes to opioids, if I have opioid use disorder, I can come to the emergency department for several different reasons. I may come to the emergency department because of that opioid use disorder. And particularly, say I run out of meds and I need more meds. Or I come in because I've had an auto accident and I'm lying on that gurney for 16 hours while I'm getting all my tests done. So that what happens if I start to go into withdrawal is I get really uncomfortable. And the early parts of withdrawal, we'll get into symptoms in detail in a sec, but they just are super uncomfortable. And what happens is the patient may, say it is that trauma patient, the 50-year-old business guy who's in this relatively minor MBA, but who's laying around forever to get his CT scan that you think is important. And he starts to get uncomfortable from withdrawal. Well, he may not say, I'm addicted to oxycodone at home. He may just become a jerk and basically say, you know, get kind of combative with you and get kind of in your face and start to kind of shift around. And if you don't if you don't recognize that that's withdrawal, and a lot of us won't in that case, we think about it in somebody who we know uses or somebody who has track marks. We don't think about it in just the run of the mill, somebody sitting around your ER. So not treating that will mean that the reason they're there, that heart attack or that, they may say, I'm out of here, dude. I am gone. So this AMA thing that Billy was talking about in that medical legal article, maybe they're leaving AMA and maybe they're being kind of a jerk because they're having early withdrawal and they know they're going to get worse and they're not going to necessarily offer to you this I'm in withdrawal. So put this on your radar. I found this part of this article really useful in people you don't necessarily assign in your brain as an opioid user. Just think about the person who's not being particularly nice or the person who wants to leave AMA. Put it in your radar. Could this be a withdrawal person who's leaving and hurting themselves unnecessarily? Because I can fix your withdrawal. I can actually deal with that. So be put that on. I love that part of this paper. I really hadn't had that in my sort of milieu of things to think about.
I liked it as well. And sometimes patients say, you know, I have to go home and feed the cats.
Yeah, exactly.
And what they mean is, sometimes they mean they have to go home and feed the cats. Sometimes they need to go home and take some oxycodone.
Yeah, so, exactly.
There are all kinds of reasons for AMA, and I like this part of the paper too.
I totally agree. Because what's going to happen is, if there's somebody who's a fentanyl user, they'll have withdrawal earlier. Again, it's a shorter acting drug. If it's somebody who's a heroin user, they'll have kick in their withdrawals within 6 hours. So think about how many people come into triage and then get through the system in less than 6 hours. In some places they absolutely do, but in some places they don't. And that's the person that might go into withdrawal. And their initial symptoms are what you'd expect. They get anxious, they get agitated, they get irritable. And again, their behavior is disruptive. So you say, well, that person's being a jerk. Or the nurse says, you know, I just can't handle the guy in bed three. He's driving me crazy. So we get less empathetic and we're not even picking up on this. It affects your relationship unless you're aware. So know that this is very likely to happen within an ER visit's duration that they can go into withdrawal. And if they don't get treated, if it doesn't get addressed, they know the symptoms are going to get worse. They've been through this before. They get rhinorrhea, they get lacrimation, they yawn. In fact, yawning is a clue to you. If somebody's getting kind of irritable and they start yawning a lot, just have that spidey sense say, oh, I remember something about yawning. And yawning
is... Right, because yawning doesn't go with them being irritated and in your face.
Not at all.
Yawning goes with them going to sleep. But if they're irritated and in your face and then they yawn... That's really a red flag.
It is, and you're going to become a much better provider in picking up on that. You're going to say, oh, man, I need to address this with somebody because I can fix that. I still want to take care of the reason that they're here, but that's now becoming a newer issue. I want to fix that because they will go on, and they'll have nausea and vomiting. They'll get diarrhea. They get cramping like crazy, myalgias, insomnia. It's just bad, and they get hypertensive and sweaty. Their pupils get big. They get pyloerection. That's another thing. It's a little later finding, but if they are yawning and they're pacing around and they're saying they're nauseated and they have goosebumps, it's another thing that tells you they may actually have opioid withdrawal that's causing their symptoms. As far as like this withdrawal issue, there are tools to this. So if you finally identify it, it's like, oh, Mrs. Smith, let's talk a little bit. Have you been taking any medicines? Oh, you do. You know, the symptoms you're having may be withdrawal. I can address that. What helps us kind of know how bad they are is there are scales for this. It's called COWS, the Clinical Opioid Withdrawal Scale. It's actually something you can use in the ER. I threw it into the slides here for your information. So it's a way to kind of get an idea of how bad they are and but honestly, if you just even pick it up in the first place and know that you need to address it, you are 99% of the ballgame. This just gives you a number to kind of follow and an idea of how much you're getting better. But be smart. If you give them something to help them feel better and they feel better, boom, you're like, good for you. You're already partly down the line. So what can
And we use COWS routinely with our drug counselors at Stony Brook.
And that's because you have the resources, right? So if you don't have the resources and you were smart enough to notice the yawning and the goosebumps in that irritable person and you picked up on it, good for you. And treat it, and you don't necessarily, if you don't have somebody to follow a score, then forget it. Just give yourself a pat on the back and take care of that patient. Because you have some options here as far as treating. And I'll tell you, buprenorphine has changed the world. It is just so incredibly cool. pardon me, it's a partial mu agonist. So basically it causes some opioid agonism, but it also has a super high affinity. So what it does is it blocks it from everybody else. So it does a little bit of activation, but not as much as all the other jazz, and it blocks anything else from getting there. So and it has a really long half-life, 24 to 60 hours. So it's a really great drug to get in there and kind of just coat that receptor in a way that blocks everybody else from getting there. Now, the problem is it does cause some antagonism. It does block that receptor some. So if somebody's currently, you know, has a lot of opioid on board, you can precipitate withdrawal with buprenorphine. So what you have to do, it's like this little Goldilocks thing. They have to be withdrawing at least partly, mildly. They don't have to be super sick. So to say somebody comes up to you and says, I want to quit. I'm in the ER, got my ankle sprained. Now that I'm here, I'm talking to you, I want to quit. I'm stuck on oxycodone. I have been for a while. What you're going to do is you're going to say, good for you. That is so awesome. Let me know when you start to feel the symptoms that you know you get when you need more. Because that's going to be the time where you can now start to treat them. Because if you give them buprenorphine right away, you may precipitate withdrawal and make things worse. And how long that window is of waiting depends on what they take. It's shorter with things like heroin and oxycodone, 6 to 12 hours, longer with stuff like methadone, which have super long half-lives. So the traditional dosing that you would do if you were treating this withdrawal in the ER was 2 to 4 milligrams as a sublingual form, watch them for an hour to hour and a half, and then if they're still symptomatic, give some more. So 2 to 4 milligram increments to tell they're better to a max of about 6 to 12, or excuse me, 8 to 12 per day. It turns out, though, if somebody's really been on it for a while, they use heavy doses of things, high doses of things, that you can actually start higher. And a lot of people in the emergency department will start at 4 to even 8 milligrams to start, to basically get this thing under control pretty rapidly and titrate them. They may need higher doses. And again, once you get used to using this, you'll kind of find the sweet spot for this thing for any individual patient. And we do know that there's a ceiling effect to this. This sort of, I get a little bit high from buprenorphine. Well, that has a cap on dosing that eventually goes away. So that actually ends up being kind of a good thing about buprenorphine. Now, the thing about buprenorphine is that because people can get a little bit high from this, they get a little bit of a rush from this, there is a theoretic risk of addiction, sort of this, I like it, to buprenorphine. So what we want to do basically in those folks is give them naloxone. So you want to prevent them from having abuse of buprenorphine by giving them naloxone. You shouldn't do that in pregnant patients. You're not supposed to use naloxone in pregnant patients. Excuse me, my cat is behind me. To get the cat off of the counter. Okay, so we know that we don't want to give that to pregnant patients. So don't do that. Buprenorphine is fine, but not the naloxone itself. Now, that combo, that buprenorphine naloxone, is a fabulous combo. But we know methadone is one way to treat people as well. You can use that in somebody you're admitting in the emergency department. The problem with methadone, though, as a treatment, is they have to have, the dosing is tailored, it has a long half-life, they have to be in a follow-up program. It turns out it's fine, but it's something that needs to be in a system. They need to go to a methadone program, they get it prescribed at home. You don't have to have that with buprenorphine. You don't have to have this whole sort of structured, legal, organized system. This is something we can actually treat overall. Now, the other thing to know about methadone, I didn't know this actually. Methadone can prolong the QT interval. I didn't know that. I maybe should have, but I didn't. So if you have other things that prolong that interval, be careful. And if methadone is used, know that liver disease, cytochrome P450 inducing agents, and other drugs that injure the liver can basically increase the half-life of that because it just doesn't get metabolized as well. Now, a couple of the things in treating symptoms of opioid withdrawal. So clonidine has been around forever as a possible treatment for opioid withdrawal. It's not an on-label use, it's off-label. And it does control some of those end organ symptoms that go with that. So think about it. I am tremulous. I am sweaty. All the things that are basically adrenergic that go with opioid withdrawal are treated with clonidine. So what it does is takes withdrawal that can be like hypertension, tachycardia, it muffles that down, it damps that down, so it's less likely to be severe. And the dosing, if you're going to use it for this indication, is 0.1 milligram orally every 6 hours, titrated to symptoms with a max of 0.4 in a 24-hour time period. So this is a titrated deal. You can give it transdermally as well. I'll tell you, in the ER, I haven't found this wildly helpful. I think this is more used in sort of the go-to-detox kinds of places. Bradycardia hypotension can happen with this, and it doesn't work alone. It has to be used with something else. So it's not a sole agent. So it's something I'm not wild about using in the ER. I haven't used it a lot, so I don't have a ton of experience. And I know it's mainly used in these sort of clinics for people who want to detox. Now, symptomatic treatment covers the gamut. Remember, if you think about the symptoms of somebody who's having opioid withdrawal, there is a lot of things. They get nausea, vomiting, belly pain, all kinds of stuff. Well, a lot of those symptoms can be treated so that people are more comfortable while they go through the withdrawal. So for cramping, you can give disoclamine. Remember, if they're volume depleted, you're going to want to give IV fluids, because sometimes they are. They may have been trying to do this at home, going cold turkey, and they've been vomiting and having diarrhea. Treat each symptom, so diarrhea with something like loperamide, or dyspepsia with famotidine if they have that. If they're vomiting, give them ondansetron. Pain, again, non-opioid pain medicines, so acetaminophen, ibuprofen are fine. If they can't sleep, which is a pretty common problem, they can use something like trazodone. There's lots of options here for you to use to treat the symptoms while they're going through the withdrawal process to get this out of their system. Now, the thing that really hit the news in 2015 is there's a guideline published on what's called medication-assisted therapy. Now, technically, methadone has been sort of medication-assisted therapy. This is a version that uses buprenorphine. So this medical-assisted therapy thing, which we've been doing forever with methadone, now has a new concoction that we can use using buprenorphine and something that's an antagonist, like naloxone or naltrexone. We'd like to, again, try to avoid the methadone group, because that involves this whole treatment program and this whole rigid system. If we could use something that's non-methadone based, we could get people into outpatient clinics or into a primary care practice that does this, or into somebody where they can actually have many more resources as an outpatient to keep their treatment going for their opioid addiction or opioid use disorder. So what this does, and why is this important? So it turns out that medication-assisted therapy, we've known this with methadone, but it's even more compelling now with the newer drugs, is it improves long-term outcomes, which is great, and it decreases the chance of overdosing. So it just does, it is really a win-win, majorly win-win. And if people use something like buprenorphine, they'll find that if they're on that for a year, okay, they've been on this for medical-assisted therapy for a while, they have less ED visits and less hospitalizations. There's a lot of positive health effects of trying to do this. So let's sort of get into sort of how to do this. So initiating it in the ED, can you do that? You bet your life you can. It's been shown to be efficacious and safe. And it started again with the buprenorphine in the ER. So you're going to start it, once the patient started to withdraw, you're going to start that medication in the emergency department. You can give them 72 hours worth of a prescription to go home with till they can get into the follow-up system. And they need to go to their clinic or a primary care office that does this, somewhere where they can get follow-up. And the randomized control trials say that comparing this to just behavioral therapy, you're much more likely to basically keep people off it, addicted people off the drug, less opioid use per week, and it's much more cost effective. Now, there's a waiver for this. So if you decided you wanted to do this and have your own clinic, for instance, or if you do outpatient care and you wanted to follow people, you need to have a waiver, which is, they need to get rid of this thing. But anyway, you do. The DEA, it's called your license, which is now a DEA license, becomes a DEAX license. So those of us who are waivered have on our license, our DEA license X, after our number, so that they know that we have this X waiver. We've taken an 8-hour course for physicians. It's longer for nurse practitioners. And it teaches you lots of things, like who is the right person to think about this for? What kind of medicines and how should I use them? How do I get a waiver to prescribe? Those sorts of things are what you learn about in this particular course. But I want to tell you something that's really, really important. Anybody listening to this call, anybody, is that if you are working in an emergency department, you do not need to have a waiver to prescribe buprenorphine. You can do it in the ER, and you can do it for that 72-hour window. Even as an outpatient, for the bridge, you can completely do that. So don't go run to get waivered just so that you feel like you can use it in the ER. You can use it now. If you want to follow up on people, that's when you really need that waiver. So this 72-hour rule is what we fall under, where we can dispense it. We can bridge somebody for 72 hours to get them into that clinic, and it gives them time to get that follow-up taken care of. It's wonderful. Now, so your job now, if you're going to get somebody launched into the 72-hour bridge, is make sure that they meet the criteria, and their specific criteria for what opioid use disorder is, and you can look this up. There are sort of checkbox things that you diagnose somebody with that. You're going to make sure that their comorbidities make them still a candidate to have this done, and then you can go ahead and start that in the ED or even prescribe them to start it at home. They all should get naloxone rescue, a kit for naloxone rescue. Now, some of the prescriptions that you use as an outpatient are combined already, where they have naloxone and buprenorphine as a single agent. If it's not, though, you'll need to have naloxone as well so that they have it as a rescue and know how to use that. If there's something, if they end up with either going back and using opioids themselves or having too much of the buprenorphine, which isn't quite as much of an issue. And again, you need to make sure they get continued follow-up here, which means you have to have a link. You have to have a way to get them there. So our treatment that works overall is the medical assisted therapy. I put you on a medicine. I get some sort of psychological intervention for you, a psychiatrist, a social worker, somebody who deals with sort of opioid use disorders, and then social support and case management to help you with your home situation and how it's affected your marriage and your work environment, etc. And this from the ED can be pretty challenging. And our job right now, if you're going to do this 72-hour window bridge, is to make sure you have in place a system where it's easy for the patient to get into the next part of this. Because that bridge time is the hot transition from ER to actually getting into the program, into the system, is the highest risk time for the patient. It needs to start within 72 hours. And again, some people, I suspect it to Stony Brook, I mean, Billy can weigh in, they have this setup where they can bridge them and send them right to Clinic X that will take care of them. If not, if you don't have that in your system already, then you need to find the areas in the area that you can. And then the one last thing to kind of clinch that loop is what's called a warm handoff, where you say, I'm seeing, you know, Mr. Jones, we've identified his opioid use disorder, we're doing our 72-hour bridge, he's going to come see you with, you know, 2 days from now, he's doing great right now, no other medical problems, whatever. You do a warm hand. It's like any other sign out. So this will help, and sometimes it helps to even get the patient, well, very much the patient, but sometimes even the family involved, if that's what the patient would like. So to kind of summarize this linkage, basically the transitioning care from the ED, start the treatment in the ER, make sure that there's an outpatient facility where they can get the follow-up medical assisted therapy ongoing with counseling available, social services, good referral, and a warm handoff will increase your transition. So this article, which honestly is a pretty clean, clear approach to what you need to do and how you need to do this, it basically just says opioid use disorder is really common and it is really morbid. It's between death and just affecting your life. It's just a big, big deal. We are a place where they come to get seen. So we are a place where things can get done. We can start things. If we decrease morbidity and mortality for that person. So it's really important. It's like you would tell somebody who's hypertensive to take it antihypertensive. It's really important. And the medications you can use, there's specific stuff to treat withdrawal symptoms and then to treat addiction itself. There's buprenorphine, methadone, naloxone, and actually naltrexone, which isn't on this list. And then our job is to get them into that outpatient system. Linkage the best way you can. Get a waiver if you want to, and you can do this on your own. We can do the 72-hour rule and make sure that follow-up is arranged. So I think a great article, Billy. I'm not sure how this sinks in with your practice there in Stony Brook, but I thought this was pretty great.
So it sinks in very, very much with what we do. And, you know, there was a period of transition that was maybe, I don't know, 18 months ago where, you know, it was hard sort of getting the pharmacies to real, you know, you'd write the 72-hour bridge, they wouldn't fill it.
Right.
Or even the pharmacy at Stony Brook wouldn't give it to us. And so we said, no, I don't have to have an X to give it in the emergency department. So there were a few glitches sort of getting it started. The drug counselors and the usage of the cows to make sure you're not giving it until they're actually withdrawn, all of that stuff has been pretty well streamlined. And I could tell you one thing. They come back less. Mentioned it's a win-win. The third win is they don't come back as much. And so getting that done is really useful. You'll see people who know exactly their doses. They're like, you know, I actually ran out on Wednesday. Now it's Friday. I'm afraid I'm going to use on the weekend. And they'll come in. They'll tell you exactly what their doses are and what they're doing. And they're not a fuss. You give it to them. And they're like, no, I got the, I got the reversal kits, the safety stuff. You're like, wonderful. And you look and you say, oh, yeah, they were seen by Bob, 2 months ago.
Yeah, I just think this is something that's so important. Yeah. This is destroying families, and this is destroying people's lives. And people who are addicted to opioids, there's a lot of science behind why they're addicted. It isn't just that they're weak or they can't. There's a lot of really good science that says people don't like being addicted to opioids. It's not something they choose to do, and it really, really destroys lives. So we really can have an impact on that in a way that we just have to like put our frustration or judgment or whatever aside and treat this like any other medical condition that we can actually do some major intervention on that really helps.
I think one of the misperceptions, Di, and this paper did talk about it, is that the reason they started how they got addicted was because they liked the high. And I'll tell you my own experience. When I had my motorcycle accident and I left the hospital, they gave me like, I remember they gave me like 50 oxycodone.
That's
I was
crazy.
Like, who the hell needs 50? But, and I also had a regional pain control device with the, you know, the dial on it. And once that dial device was over and I pulled that thing out, that was the ropivacaine doser, and started using the opiates, it was interesting. They, at least I didn't perceive any high from them. But I remember when I needed a follow-up prescription after 50, I remember thinking and saying, actually, to my other half, that if I need one after this, there's a problem. And I never felt high, but as I was going on with this, what I found was, one, I couldn't sleep if I wasn't taking them, and two, if I started weaning myself down, I got irritable and nasty, and I managed to handle that on my own. But the idea that I was doing this to get high was completely untrue, and it was so subtle how it snuck up on it. So that's a lot of people have ended up in this situation through similar experience.
Oh yeah, I think we probably all know people. I suspect if you really look around you or you've talked to some of your friends, there are people who say, "Man, I had no idea that I was going to end up taking Vicodin, you know, 6 months later after I had my, you know, ankle surgery." And what it's very insidious.
Yeah, people think, "Oh, they took it because they really liked it." I never got high on it. It was that I couldn't sleep and was, you know, irritable without it. And then that's when I had to get the refill prescription, I was like, I remember saying, "Listen, if I need another one of these, we got a problem." And because of that, I was able to kind of management, you know, here I am in the ER doc seeing this all the time. And it still was sneaky.
Right.
Okay, that's a wrap. We encourage your comments or questions. You can reach us at support@ccme.org. And please check our library of educational content at ccme.org. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.